It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Testimony confirms to Fox News that Nellie Orr told House investigators that she was tasked with doing opposition research during the 2016 campaign on Melania Trump as well as the president's children. Last October on Capitol Hill, Orr confirmed that the tasking came from Fusion GPS, the same opposition research firm that was paid by the DNC and Clinton campaign for the unverified Trump dossier that was later used to secure a surveillance warrant for a Trump campaign aide. Quote, as I recall, I did some research on all of them, but not into much depth, Orr said. Question, how about Donald Trump Jr.? Did you do more in-depth research on Donald Trump Jr. than some of the others? Or, I'm afraid it was relatively superficial. I looked into some of his travels. Ivanka Trump? I looked into some of her travels. The goal was to see whether they were involved in dealings and transactions with people who had any suspicious past. The congressional testimony also revealed a July 30, 2016 breakfast meeting here in Washington, D.C. at the Mayflower Hotel with Nellie Orr, her husband, Justice Department official Bruce Orr, and former British spy Christopher Steele, who researched the dossier, and one of Steele's business associates. Almost immediately after, Bruce Orr went to senior FBI and Justice Department officials about Steele's dossier work. And here's the context. The Orrs really are like the connective tissue in this whole surveillance abuse allegation. That the connective tissue between Fusion GPS, Glenn Simpson, the British spy Christopher Steele, the dossier, and then on the other hand, FBI and senior Justice Department officials. We asked Nellie Orr's attorney if he wanted to provide comment or context for our reporting, but there was no response.
It was Catherine Herridge on Fox. This is Sandy Rios with you. It is really, really ironic. And that you will see clearly by the time we end our discussion today about how the left, we'll call them the left, has attempted to show that President Donald Trump has been involved and controlled, was allowed to be successful as president because of Vladimir Putin and the Russians. When in fact, the players involved in coming after President Donald Trump, in discrediting him, in developing a dossier, in passing out the dossier, in publishing it, in daily lambasting him and trying to make some link, have themselves very strong ties with the communist left. It's pretty shocking. And there is a new book that talks about it. I'll introduce our guest in just a second. But in part, she writes this way, stripping away labels and traditions, what is readily apparent is a unifying drive to save not America, but the globalist system that was created in the aftermath of World War II, anchored in such institutions as the United Nations and the World Bank. Both of these globalist institutions, not at all incidentally, were shepherded into existence by two key Soviet agents covertly embedded inside the U.S. government, Alger Hiss and Harry Dexter White. So if a coup is being attempted against the Trump presidency because it represents the first serious counter-movement to reestablish the building blocks of the nation-state and thus imperil the global system, we are enduring a phase of American politics as far away from usual as a Bolshevik plot. It's the nationalists versus the globalists. Is that just another way of thinking about the anti-communists versus the communists? Are we again, or rather still, facing our old enemy? Marxism? Is ideology the missing X factor that we overlook in our efforts to understand recent events? Does a red thread run through the anti-Trump conspiracy? That's what our next guest writes. And I think as you hear her talking about the background of Nellie Orr, of John Brennan, of James Comey, of the FBI, of Fusion GPS of Christopher Steele, the British spy, the gentleman who was involved with Nellie Orr to create that phony tabloid dossier where Trump was allegedly, you know, behaving in shameful ways in a Russian hotel. It's just an amazing story because each of them, including, and we're going to start with, I think, Nellie Orr, have links to Russia. Nellie is a Russian expert. Nellie has waxed eloquent on the glories of Joseph Stalin. You're going to hear about all of this when I introduce our next guest. Diana West is an award-winning journalist. She's an author, blogger, columnist, researcher. The last time we talked to Diana about an actual book she wrote, it was called American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. This new book that she has just written is called The Red Thread, A Search for Ideological Drives Inside the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. Diana, the first question is, what is it about communism that fascinates you so? Why does that draw so much of your expertise and research? And what is your background that's interesting to you?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know that anyone's ever asked me that. I would say I'm not actually interested in communism at all. However, I see it attacking, undermining, and destroying everything I love about our Western civilization, our constitution, our culture, our religion, our education. I mean, I see it as the enemy. Let's put it this way. I'm a very strong anti-communist, and I am drawn to it because I think it is still a hot threat. And what has happened to our understanding of really counterintelligence, the tools by which we defend ourselves against subversion, against enemies foreign and domestic, have really been taken from us over the past, let's say, 50 years. And so I guess when I start looking at, you know, existential problems, political warfare, etc., I tend to see the same culprit. And what the Red Thread is doing is trying to reintroduce the context for understanding so much of the battle that we are in as this age-old struggle between, you know, liberty and tyranny or anti-communism and communism.
You know, it's interesting, as I was thinking about our time together this morning, I was thinking about how often I talk about the threads of communism because I grew up, you know, during the Cold War and lived in East Berlin and visited, you know, I've been to every communist country except for Cuba. So this is really high on my radar too. And yet when I start to discuss it and its influence on what's happening, there are sort of like roadblocks or inabilities to really connect, to really make the point. It's like you start and then you just can't quite finish and land the plane. And you've made a concerted effort here to actually track some of the key players on this attack against President Trump, attempt to link him with the Russians and to blame his win or attribute his win to the presidency on to his connection with Russia, and the players in that, you make a concerted effort, investigative, to link them to this red thread, actually, to communism. And so let's get real specific about this.
Yeah.
You start out talking about Bruce and Nellie Orr. And some of these names will be familiar to my audience, but we have to kind of reset. I'm going to just say this, Diana. Nellie Orr, her picture always reminds me of a Russian apparatchik, of a woman, of a, you know, Dr. Zhivago walking down the streets, communist woman. I'm sorry. That's what she looks like to me. That's a silly thing. But seriously, who were they and what have you learned? That's a big, broad question.
Well, they're a great jumping. Bruce and Nellie Orr as a couple are a wonderful jumping off point. And I will say they were my jumping off point because when you're looking at these anti-Trump conspirators, you know, you see these generic suits. You see FBI director and CIA. You see these big resumes and impressive law degrees, things like that, that you can't really penetrate in terms of understanding who these people are. Nellie Orr, who worked for Fusion GPS and may indeed have been the lead author on the so-called Steele dossier. Nellie Orr was the Russia expert there, and she was married to Bruce Orr, who at this time during the campaign season, 2016, was as the fourth highest official at the Justice Department, a career Justice Department official, probably the senior career official, and he was instrumental in moving this information into the FBI and into the whole process by which we had domestic spying through the FISA court on the Trump team and later on the Trump presidency. So they are a focal point operating at the heart of it. Nelly was an academic. She was a professor at Vassar in the 1990s. She wrote book reviews. She wrote a PhD thesis. In other words, all of a sudden, there is a thread to pick up and try to understand her mindset. So as an experiment, I thought to gather as much of her publicly available writings and start to read them. Problem is, they're very, very boring, very academic, very dry. It took a while for me to kind of get into the code of it all. But it became very clear and in very uncoded language that this was a person who saw great virtues in Stalin's 1930s Russia, the Soviet Union. I mean, this is someone who was weighing, quote, the paradoxes of the Stalin era. You know, oh, yes, well, they murdered millions of people, and yet they were creating a new legal system. I mean, literally, this is the kind of discussion you see in her work. She talks about the terror and excitement of the Stalin era. I mean, I have never encountered a modern-day person who would speak in those terms about what we know now so much of Stalin's Soviet era, where they give these huge numbers, something like 20 million, 30 million people were murdered by the Soviet state. No one I know sees a paradox in that or would weigh the good with the bad. It was all bad. And so this is the kind of academic she was, and this is now the kind of conspirator she is. I mean, this becomes an important clue to the kind of person she is. She's very in favor of the state reordering the society, and this becomes a common, well, it's something right out of communism, but it becomes a very common thread, if you will, among many of the other conspirators that I looked at once I had this kind of opening through the door.
You know, one thing you point out that I've always wondered about, well, I didn't really wonder, I knew the answer, but I didn't know the details. You know, how is it that, I'll just go back, Bill Clinton went to the Soviet Union in the 1980s.
Yes.
I think it was the 80s or maybe the 70s.
No, worse. He went something like the winter of 1969,
okay.
Deep freeze, Cold War.
Okay, so there we have Bill Clinton going into the
student. Yes.
Yeah, as a poor student. And then we have Bernie Sanders spending his honeymoon in Moscow. And then we have Nelly Orr studying, you know, in the archives.
In the Soviet Union.
And so I'll let you, you know, just, I know, but I'll let you. How hard was it for people to go to the Soviet Union then, Diana?
Well, it was very hard. And certainly as an academic or as a student, as Bill Clinton was, or an academic preparing to actually do research there, you had to have approval of essentially the KGB, the security services. When American scholars went to the Soviet Union to study, they had to submit their theses, ideas, their proposals. They had to have their research carefully prepared for them. They were not allowed to just walk into a library and start checking stuff out. I mean, this is not the way it worked. It's not the way it works now either, I would add. So in order to get that approval, you had to already be in sync with the ideology. You had to be comfortable with having a state trim your ideology or trim your ideas and direct your research. You had to essentially coming to earn a Soviet degree in essence if you agree to all of these restrictions, and then you come home with all of this original quote research and you get a big job at an elite American school and you teach a revisionist history of the Soviet Union that downplays the horror and talks about the good points of communism, and then fast forward to Ocasio-Cortez. I mean, this is the way it worked in terms of the takedown of our colleges and universities that have created these cadres that are now openly talking about communism and socialism as a political choice for Americans to make in our electoral process. So it's a long thread, So it's very important to really kind of reacquaint ourselves with these ideas and with this history. And I wrote the book, Sandy, I hope you noticed, very short. This is a short book because I tried to be as streamlined as possible because we're just inundated with information. Yes. I mean, I despair every time another one of these testimonies from, you know, is released, you know, like the Bruce Orr testimony last week, hundreds of pages of just raw conversation. This little book is quite streamlined.
Yes, it is. Let me just say, by the way, it's published by the Center for Security Policy, and we're going to make it available on our Facebook page. And my guest is Diana West. We're just starting. We're talking about this red thread between this attempt to take down President Trump. Stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
He rose to the ranks of the Bolshevik Revolution. He was utterly, in the most unalloyed sense, the most ruthless man in Russia. He would do anything to advance what he thought were the goals of the revolution and to advance his own personal place in it. In many ways, the Russian people were saved by him at the beginning of World War II because of his steel will. He took the name Stalin because of the man of steel. And when the Germans turned and began to invade Russia, they underestimated Joe Stalin. He stayed in Moscow even though they got within 40 miles of the center of the capital. And when Stalingrad, the battle for Stalingrad, began, he gave orders that can only now be described as the most blood-curdling, ruthless orders imaginable. No one will abandon their post. And over the course of that fight, which went on for almost 2 years, almost a million people perished. And they had 400,000 people in a Russian battalion who were the enforcers. So if you thought you might give up, you'd get shot. And here, I think, is the most devastating portrait of Stalin of all. The siege of Stalingrad was so great, there was no food on either side. So the German soldiers would give little children who were residents of Stalingrad a crust of bread if they would fill their canteens from the Volvo River. And as the children came back into Stalingrad, they were shot by Stalin snipers. That's how he consolidated his power. The most feared man in Russia, and with very good reason.
It's Tom Brokaw with a little tiny vignette about Joseph Stalin, the person that took the Marxist ideology further than Lenin did, and of course killed 20 million of his people. Joseph Stalin was a former seminary student who later, when he was talking with Winston Churchill and Roosevelt, actually confessed that it was Satan that he listened to. He really was ruthless. He was so, even his only wife and children talk about it. And yet Nellie Orr, who was the, had her hands very deeply in the Russian dossier against President Trump, studied in Russia at a time when it was very difficult to get in there. She thought that, in her writing, that Stalin's period of governance in Russia was filled her with terror and excitement. As she read about it. Okay, so Diana West is my guest. Her new book is called The Red Thread, A Search for Ideological Drives Inside the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. So I think we've touched on Nellie's part of this quite a bit, Diana.
Yes.
Let's weave in Christopher Steele, the British agent, who was also deeply involved with this. What do you know about him?
Well, Christopher Steele, I think of as Nellie Orr's opposite number, because one thing we didn't mention about Nellie is that she has a connection to the CIA. She took out a ham radio operator's license in the spring of 2016, which for Cold War buffs raises some eyebrows, because that was a way that spies communicated pretty safely without surveillance from whatever the state was, the security services. We now know, just from last week, that she had at least 6 years as an independent contractor with the CIA. We don't know if she was ever on staff. We don't know if she knew John Brennan. However, we do know this relationship exists. We now turn to Christopher Steele, who spent just shy of 20 years as a British intelligence officer, part of MI6, who, as a student, this is where we pick him up because, of course, we don't know much about any intelligence officers. They're supposed to be anonymous to the public. we know about him from his Cambridge years, where he was a prominent student. He became the president of the Cambridge Union. And according to British press, who did some interviews about these times in his life in his 20s, he was a, quote, confirmed socialist. He also earned what was called in the story CND credentials. CND in the 1980s and 1970s was a very strongly Marxist-oriented organization known as the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. And they were essentially deploying against, it was kind of a front group, they were deploying against American and NATO policy, defense policy against the Soviet Union. They were hewing to a Soviet line. This is very interesting to me because when Christopher Steele becomes involved in the spring of 2016 with the creation of this dossier, in whatever capacity, this was about the time, it was after the time that President Trump, then candidate Trump, gave that very amazing foreign policy address of, I believe, the end of March 2016, where he specifically addresses the need to rebuild our nuclear arsenal and essentially revamp our military posture, which has been just so sorely damaged and degraded by all these years of war in Afghanistan, Iraq, elsewhere, and no modernization under Obama, etc. I wonder if that was a call to arms to the old CND socialist Steele. Don't know the answer to that, but his ideological bias was very strong as a young man, and there are other little things that sort of pop out along the years that suggest he used to this. He had a desperate, according to Bruce Orr, he was desperate that Trump not be elected and was a very active conspirator, as we're finding out, you know, every day we're finding out new information. So that is the Christopher Steele piece of it that really nicely tracks Nellie Orr. I mean, isn't it amazing to find in this anti-Trump conspiracy such hard leftists? I mean, these are not just Democrats. The hallmark of our government is the peaceful transition of power. Your party loses in the presidentials or the midterm elections. Well, guess what? You try again next time. That's what we do. That's what we always do. We come in and out of power according to what, you know, the political favor is of the day. This was so abnormal. It looks like a Soviet-style conspiracy, something out of totalitarian world. And then when you find the beliefs of the conspirators track with that, I think you have to keep looking to see what this is all about.
Yeah. Diana, there's other people. I want to, this is Tony. Pretty stunning. Now, John Brennan, who was the director of the CIA under Barack Obama, I've reported many times on this microphone that it is reported that he converted to Islam, also that he voted for the Communist Party candidate Gus Hall in 1980 in the presidential election.
1976.
And you've gone into this in greater detail. Please tell us what you've learned about John Brennan.
Yes. Well, just to remember what 1976 was like, just for a minute. I mean, this was again deep freeze, Cold War. Brezhnev was the dictator of Russia at the time. You had the foreign minister Andrei Gromyko, you know, flatly stating the Communist Party and the Soviet Union are, you know, on the march, essentially in that interesting language that they used. This was a very big moment. We had terrorism, the rise of hijackings, the PLO, the IRA. You had a tremendous kind of alignment of violent forces in the world under Moscow, essentially, or certainly helping Moscow in its war against the free world led by the United States.
Diana,
this is the moment.
Hold that thought just a sec. I just want to interject on a personal note. I was living in Berlin, Germany in 1973 and 74. And I can tell you, just I can say amen, sister, to just what you said. I lived there on the front lines. My husband was in the military. I used to travel into East Berlin. The tensions, the world tensions were incredible. His Henry Kissinger was flying into our airport all the time. I stayed with State Department officials. Listen, the tension, the news. There was no mistake that Russia was our enemy, enemy. And they were, responsible for that wall that divided Berlin. That was the source of contention there. But I just want to say that was the kind of tension in which now you're going to tell what John Brennan did.
Right. Well, it's important to remember that, and thank you for the personal insight. This is something that becomes so inexplicable for a normal American patriot. John Brennan, at that point that you're describing and I'm looking back on, John Brennan decides to vote for Brezhnev's chief representative in the United States, Gus Hall, for decades the leader of the Communist Party, USA, himself a convicted revolutionary who tried to overthrow the United States government by violence. John Brennan tells us this was a useful protest vote. And my question becomes, protest against what? I mean, this is not the way the American system works. You don't vote for revolution. You vote for different politics. You get involved. I mean, this is how extreme these people are. And people would say, well, he was only 21 years old at the time, which is certainly a valid comment. I don't know many 21-year-olds who would have those feelings, but, you know, we do grow and change. But a few years later, 4 years later, as he's about to enter the CIA, he graduates from a master's program down at University of Texas, and he writes a master's paper that, to me, and I have a lot of quotations in the red thread so people can evaluate this, to me show great sympathy for the kinds of policies of land expropriation and so on under the socialist dictator of Egypt, Nasser, that he was studying and comparing to the next leader, Sadat, at that time, who was leading and also sort of turning more toward the United States and away from the Soviet Union. So this becomes, you know, he's a mature person. We also know from his discussion of entering the CIA that he faced a real problem when they said to him on his polygraph, have you ever supported or been involved with groups that are dedicated to the overthrow of the United States? And he discussed this in September 2016 and basically said, so I decided to be honest and say I voted for Gus Hall in 1976. And he thought he was washed up. He was not. He was accepted. But what is also interesting to me about this anecdote is, according to his telling of this entrance exam to the CIA, there was no follow-up question. There was no follow-up question as to, was there anything else? Are you involved with anything else now? Have you continued? He put one thing out there, and they moved on. So either you have a very lax polygraph administrator or a sympathetic one, and we really don't know. But we can see that John Brennan had a very swift rise at the CIA, and as we all know, he became director. There are other things to discuss about John Brennan, but this was certainly the most overt and open time of his life, where you go from supporting the Communist Party in the United States and continuing with these sentiments as a graduate student entering the CIA.
Yeah, and the other thing, you titled this chapter about John, the red-green John Brennan, and of course we talk about the red-green axis here pretty often, yeah. Diane, and that's the link between communism and Islam, the Sharia-adherent Islam Muslims. And
yes.
You do mention what I, at greater length, his conversion to Islam while
yes.
he was the Saudi chief for the CIA.
Yes, yes, as attested to by former special agent of the FBI, John Guandolo, a friend to us all and a great Islam expert, Muslim subversion expert, and also a former CIA station chief named Brad Johnson, who also has this same story to tell. So it's a very compelling story that Brennan has not been grilled on, and none of this seems to come up. I mean, you wonder how these people in their confirmation hearings for these important posts, whether it's James Comey, we could also address, because he too was a
yes,
communist
I want
in
to,
his college years.
In a minute. Yes, I do
yes,
want to.
How they don't, how they, these questions never come up on, yeah. on in confirmation to these highest, most critical jobs that we can possibly have, working for the American people to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United yeah. States.
So John Brennan is appointed by President Obama to be the head of the CIA. And then when President Trump comes into the picture, Brennan goes after him with a vengeance. And then his role in this, the direct role against Trump, is the dossier. He distributes it, as I understand it. He was part of the distribution to the media, right?
It seems to be. It's all a little murky. He certainly seems to be. And he has not been called on the carpet to really explain, to my knowledge, his exact role. But he also, it's been reported that he also created what was called an interagency working group at Langley, at the CIA headquarters, in the summer of 2016, as part of this effort to spy on the Trump campaign. And my question goes to Nellie Orr's involvement in that, and also Stefan Halper, who was the FBI CIA asset who we know was an informant trying to get inside the Trump campaign and penetrate the inner circles there. We don't exactly know the mechanics of any of this. We don't know who was calling the shots. We don't know. We can't really draw a picture yet of how this conspiracy has been functioning. You know, it's all in pieces still. So these are all good questions that we can't quite set in stone yet. And I certainly hope we do. I despair of that. But I mean, you know, the more heat, the better here, and the more light, the better.
Yeah, Diana, the thing, the little piece of this that shocked me the most, honestly, because I knew nothing about this, and you began it. So let's pick it up. We only have a few minutes before the next break, but let's at least get started. Former FBI Director James Comey. Now, I know he's like done some really wacky things, but an affiliation to the Communist Party is a shocker to me. So lay that out for us, please.
Yes, and before I do, I just wanted to say one thing. James Comey is the one who testified that Putin threw his support to Trump because he hated Hillary. I think that's a piece of disinformation for many reasons that I lay out in the book. But getting to his communist involvement, I don't know if he was literally a party member. However, he himself, in an interview in 2003, declared that in college at William & Mary, this would be in the, he graduated in 1982, considered himself to be a communist. And this is very shocking, too. Someone who starts out a communist and ends up FBI director. And how far did he go from those youthful beliefs? Well, I don't think he went very far at all. And that is, I think, frankly, it's really the best, hardest, clearest red thread I've got in this book. James Comey and his affinity with the Christian Marxist Reinhold Niebuhr.
And hold that thought for a second. The book is called The Red Thread, A Search for Ideological Drivers Inside the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. My guest is Diana West. Yeah, this is a barn burner. Yes, it is. And you can get the book anywhere. You can also, we'll put a link to it on our Facebook page so that you can read it and share it. There's just so much, so stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Christopher Steele, the British spy at the center of the political and legal scandal of the century, was treated, quote, as a peer by the FBI. That's according to brand new in-depth investigative reporting from the Washington Post titled How a British Ex-Spy Became a Flashpoint in the Russia Probe. The Post reports the FBI investigators treated Steele as a peer, a Russia expert so well trusted that he had assisted the Justice Department on past cases and provided briefing material for British prime ministers and at least one U.S. president. And this, in one of his first cases as a private consultant, Steele worked closely with the FBI in its investigation of corruption at FIFA, the powerful worldwide soccer governing body. The Post goes on to detail a dramatic meeting between Steele and his FBI contacts in Rome, as well as a couple others that may have flown in from other locations, where Steele laid out his concerns about Donald Trump's ties to Russia, telling them, quote, the Russians had damaging information about Trump's personal behavior and finances that could be used to pressure the GOP nominee. What's more, the Kremlin was now carrying out an operation with the Trump campaign's help to tilt the U.S. election, a plot Steele had been told was ordered by Vladimir Putin. Senator John McCain figures into the story that the Post lays out as well. The Post detailing efforts by Steele to share his concerns with Republicans who shared his wariness about Russia. I call those the good old days. The piece reveals how a meeting was arranged with John McCain, who was, quote, visibly shocked by the allegations.
That's an NBC report, and isn't it interesting to hear Christopher Steele's name and hear him referred to as that he was treated as a peer with the FBI, and coming on the heels of our discussion in the last segment that James Comey has his own ties to the left. It's pretty stunning because James Comey was the FBI director at that time. We're talking with Diana West about her new book called The Red Thread, and it is a search for ideological drivers inside the anti-Trump conspiracy. Diana, let's pick up with James Comey. And you said that he was very influenced by Reinhold Niebuhr. And you, yes. It should be a familiar name, but it isn't. So tell us why that's concerning.
Well, I will say also that I could not have really given you more than one phrase about Reinhold Niebuhr before I did this research. Reinhold Niebuhr is well known as the liberal Protestant theologian. I mean, that seems to be what follows his name every time it's mentioned. He also is kind of the person that a lot of left-wing journalists will sort of throw out as his name, sort of to put a little garnish on their intellectualness, it seems to me. but I looked into it and discovered that, well, the reason I looked into it, because there, you know, again, why am I interested in communism? I'm not, but it's a problem. It's the same thing. Why am I interested in Reinhold Niebuhr? I am because Comey is fascinated by Reinhold Niebuhr. It deeply influenced, not just as a young man when he wrote his honors thesis at William & Mary about Reinhold Niebuhr and Jerry Falwell, but throughout his life. And in fact, as recently as last year when he released his memoir, A Higher Loyalty, the New York Times asked him, what were the most influential works that you have ever read on your career, on your life? And the first two he mentioned were two books written by Reinhold Niebuhr at the time when Reinhold Niebuhr himself was a militant member of the Socialist Party of the United States, who literally had called for the violent overthrow of our social order in the early 1930s, one of the titles, and one 1940, I believe, the second title is 1940, in this very out there radical Niebuhr period, where he is just on fire for the overthrow, the change, the transformation of our system, redistribution of wealth is part of it, revolution violence isn't so bad if you get to a greater good, that kind of message. I mean, this is terrifying stuff alone, but when you think of it in the mind, on the mind, as an influence on the mind of a man who not only was FBI director, he was also the number two man at the Justice Department during the second Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, I mean. This is incredible when you realize the extent to which this man has been influenced by an amoral, very Marxist-oriented philosophy of specifically justice. And I go through a number of quotations from Comey about Niebuhr and his own kind of spin on it. And it's quite terrifying because it is all about being lawless and using the power of the state for this perceived justice or love, they call it. But it's essentially redistribution of wealth, and it's essentially a cadre of dictators dictating to the rest of us. So in terms of someone who's got the law and then the security, the federal police force under his belt or under his authority, I should say, that is terrifying. And yet this is what we've been living with all of these years without ever knowing it.
You mentioned earlier that and reminded me that Comey had said that Putin did not like Trump and wanted did not like Hillary and wanted Trump to win. So what is what they've been telling us. That's been the narrative. And Comey said that, and that's what they're all saying. So what did you find out about Putin's actual, what do you know about that part of it, Diana?
Well, all I know is what makes sense. If you try to put yourself in the Kremlin and you look at a Hillary Clinton who had spent all of her career going back to her husband's presidency, first building up the Chinese military, building up Chinese communists, and all the collusion with Chinese military and fundraising that we, you know, it just can be just, we can just drown in if we go back to the history of the 1990s and the Bill Clinton administrations. Fast forward to Hillary Clinton's behaviors and activities and policies as Secretary of State under Barack Obama, and we just see nothing but goodies going to Russia, going to first, you know, Medvedev, Putin, and Putin, Medvedev. I mean, this is, it's just been an absolute party. If you go back to everything from, of course, Uranium One to this thing called Skolkovo, which was a massive high-tech transfer program that built a Silicon Valley outside of Moscow that many American and other Western companies, tech companies, contributed to, participated in, and a large proportion of them also contributed to the Clinton Foundation. I mean, we have that to look at. We can look at Russia's long-sought admission to the World Trade Organization under Barack Obama. I mean, there were a number of just positive developments that Hillary Clinton was part of, and, you know, her own statements where she talked, when she visited Russia and talked about wanting a strong Russia. I mean, all of this is very important not to forget. And even when these people do a switch on us and all of a sudden pretend to be this great cold warrior, which is how she presented herself as a candidate in 2016, it was ridiculous. And again, go back to President Trump calling for military, building up our military and specifically revamping and expanding our nuclear program, and compare that to candidate Hillary Clinton saying that we don't need to upgrade our cruise missiles, which have the same nuclear component to them, literally saying we don't need to do this. Trump saying we need to do this. If you are Mr. Putin sitting in the Kremlin, what leader would you rather see? Someone who wants to reassert American sovereignty, manufacturing, economic improvements, restore the state, nation state itself, and rebuild our military in ways that no one has thought of since Ronald Reagan, mm-hmm. Who would you prefer?
Yeah, I can't think of an answer. Yeah, so I mean, but and we also know, of course, that the Russians were very much behind this dossier.
That's well, exactly.
What's so, and of course, we also know that the left, or the, whatever you want to call them, Diana, they always accuse their enemies, that would be us, of doing what they're actually doing. That's how they neutralize and throw us off. Yes.
It's a lot of manipulation and disinformation, and it works like a charm. I mean, this is what I discovered when I wrote American Betrayal, that basically all of the history we learn and study and many, many people write and continue to learn and teach is fake. I mean, President Trump, if he thought about it, would probably call it fake history. I mean, it's there is so much manipulation of the American people using mass media and fronts and pundits who have political agendas, not the goal of distributing facts and allowing people to make up their own mind, but actually pressing political agendas, which we all know this. But when you actually see it weaponized in this incredible moment of our time where we're seeing this attack mobilized, not just against policymaking or, helping foreign powers that may oppose us come to power in foreign countries, but something inside our own country, something as serious as a kind of coup against the presidency, it is so serious, because this is something we have to be so vigilant on, because we are not getting the help we need from the media, and we're not getting the help we need from the normal establishment parties. And this is, again, why I was so drawn to this subject, because it is killing us.
Diana, one obvious question, we're almost finished. You have to ask the question of who's running this big machine? As we go back to the top, we see, I think the Clintons would have to be somewhere at the top in terms of their affiliation, and they've been doing these kinds of things, as you described, since they came to public life, and even before that, we trace Hillary Clinton's connections with Saul Alinsky. But is this an American-driven American leftist driven operation, or do you think there are other strings pulling, or are they just bonded by ideology, and without even having to organize, they're organized?
Well, that's my favorite question, and I don't have a solid answer, but I think thinking about it is extremely important. The question becomes, who is benefiting from this attack on the Trump presidency? Is Russia happy because of this, or sad? Well, of course they're happy. This is, our adversaries are very happy that Donald Trump is being undermined. And I think that that leads to other questions in terms of who is affiliated with these actors. Very complicated question, very important question, but I think the patterns with previous Kremlin-directed conspiracies and subversion and all the rest of it need to be reestablish so that we can at least investigate whether this is what we're looking at.
One other personality that you mention in your book that I want to just at least get a minute of your time on is John Kerry. John Kerry, as the former Secretary of State, did such odd things. And to some of us, it was just foolishness. But you think there's more to it, and I'd like to hear what you think.
Well, Kerry is an important person. When you look at Kerry, I thought it was very interesting to sort of go back and look at his career again, because it has been one long, very pro-communist, pro-socialist kind of journey for him. I mean, going back to his participation in the anti-war movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, where he was definitely very dismissive of the communism of the North Vietnamese, for example, and thought that the American America was the threat to the world at that time. And he said so in his own Senate testimony that was very famous. This was when Jonathan Weiner was a young man in high school and actually cotton to carry right after that and became an associate as soon as he was out of law school himself. But Kerry was sort of trained in this whole world. He, even as a young man, when he went to school with Robert Mueller, by the way, they played on several sports teams together at prep school. But even there, he was arguing for recognition of communist China at a time when this was considered a red line for America as an anti-communist nation, not to recognize communist China. We see him, of course, looking for recognition of communist North Vietnam, along with John McCain, Vietnam after the communists took over, not North Vietnam, but all of Vietnam after the war. Again, the same kind of push. We see him very vocal and working for the recognition or normalization of relations with communist Cuba very recently. So, and we also see him always conducting his own kind of foreign policy, whether it was against Ronald Reagan during the Contra time, in Nicaragua, or under President Trump when he was freelancing with the Iranians. I don't know to what end or what effect, but very strong pattern of involvement and someone who is very much part of supporting this same conspiracy against President Trump. So that
It's a fascinating, and it's called The Red Thread, and we've just touched on it. I think this is a book you're going to want to get. It's a very short read, and it's fascinating, and Diana West has been the one who penned it and who's been our guest this morning. Diana West, thank you so much. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.